You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I am thrilled to be speaking to Kurt Brownoler, an amazing American comic who, as well as having a sensational special called Perfectly Stupid, which is out now in a bewildering variety of places, as he will explain later on. You can certainly find them at kurtbrownoler.com. Yes, I've said that correctly, kurtbrownoler.com. I'm not going to spell it for you. Google what you think it is and chances are you'll find it, or check the show notes. His special is just, it's just a barnstorming, really, like a really satisfying bridge between his kind of alt sensibilities and the fact that he can definitely take the roof off in a club. And I'm just absolutely in love with him. I saw him many years ago in Montreal. I saw him years before that when he was doing a double hosting, double act with Kristen Schaal and measuring the temperature of people's crotches with a remote laser device. He also, as we will hear, kickstarted a campaign to get a skywriter to write How Do I Land? Rather memorably. So he is bubbling over with energy and enthusiasm and I was going to say comedy smarts, but that doesn't suit me at all. My point is, he's very, very clever. He's very brilliant. And there are no extras from this episode because I'm giving you the whole thing. We talked for about an hour and a quarter and every moment of it is scintillating. So here, without further ado, is Kurt Brownoler. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder, pronounce your name correctly. I'm guessing it's Brownoler. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. That's how you would guess to pronounce it?
Yeah, well, I'm closer to Germany than you
are.
Yeah, I guess so. You know what I mean? There's maybe more things like that. I'm glad I've got that right.
No, you really do. Everyone says Brownoler or Braun. Yeah. So you did it right.
Great times. Yeah. I have seen you live on a number of occasions.
Wow.
I first saw you with Kristen Schaal, mm-hmm. When you were in a Spiegel tent at the Edinburgh Festival measuring the temperature of people's crotches.
Yes,
with a laser temperature gun.
Yeah.
How long ago was that? Because I feel like that was a long time ago.
That was probably 2009.
Okay.
Because 2008, we were in a theater in Edinburgh, and then 2009 we came back. No, it's probably 2010, because okay. 2009 we came back. We did the dumbest thing, man. Because 2008 we got nominated for the Comedy Award in Edinburgh, and then 2009 we were like, well, we don't have a new show, so we're not going to go back to Edinburgh. And then Avalon, who was our manager at the time, was like, you should go back. Just go back with your old show and just do 2 week run. And then we weirdly agreed to do that, and then all the marketing materials said we were doing our old show from 2008, but then we were like, that's lame, and without telling anyone, we wrote a new show and did a totally new show, and it was confusing on eight levels. So it's all these people who are coming to see this show that won, that got nominated for an award the year before. And we just wrote it was a totally new show. I think it was still good, but it wasn't the show people were expecting. So everyone was upset. And then we didn't all, and then we also didn't get the cred for having written a new show. because everyone thought it was the old show anyway, and we had to like constantly explain. It was so dumb. And so then 2010, we just did Hot Tub in a Spiegel tent where we would just do like a couple bits and then have guests on. Right? Is that where you saw?
Would have been it. Yeah. That would have been it. Exactly. I think that may have been. Was Hannibal on that show? I think that was the year that Hannibal did his.
Hannibal was there.
Yeah, that would make sense. Okay, awesome. Well, what I loved about that was you had such a kind of alt sensibility. And I've actually played Hot Tub in your absence once when I was briefly in the States.
I'm sorry I wasn't there.
No, I'm sorry you weren't there, because now I feel like I've snuck into your house and kind of moved the things around. But that kind of Hot Tub alt sort of sensibility I just love it. I love alt Americans, because I think the idea over in the UK, at least, of an American kind of mainstream stand up, like there's a lot of associations with that.
Yeah.
Whereas people who are, and I always think, I think it's, I don't know if it's braver, I think it's nobler somehow, because there is such an established circuit in the States of flying around the place, getting your jokes, polishing them down. What I mean, it's come up on this podcast before, Stuart Lee, the way he describes American comedy, I don't know if you've heard this before, is people polishing 8 minutes about nothing into 5 minutes about even less. You know, that kind of... that sort of that idea of like a kind of razor sharp banging kill anywhere do any gig thing. Yeah. I love when Americans go, no sir, I'm going to measure the temperature of people's crotches. So just talk to me about that kind of that altness and what it means to you, because you're well known as a comic for not exactly, well, one or two stunts, you know, the skywriting and stuff, we can talk about that, but for kind of embracing absurdity in a way that relatively few Americans do.
Well, thank you for saying all those things. I think it was because I came up in New York City in the mid-2000s. First, I had been improvising for a long time. And then I wanted to start writing. And so that's when I got together with Kristen and we started Hot Tub together. And that was really the first time I had ever started to write. And so I was writing for both of us, and both of our sensibilities were just weirder than normal. And to the point where I had shied away from stand up because of that idea of what you're talking about, where it's like this kind of like a, yeah, the club comedy aspect of it was the stuff that I did not like. It was often racist. It was often sexist. It was often homophobic. It was all like the bad things of society, just reinforcing them, I felt. But then I saw Eugene Merman. And Eugene Merman, he's really like the godfather of the alt scene in the 2000s in New York City. And he had this show, Invite Them Up. And I remember seeing Eugene for the first time, and he had like a children's toy that was supposed to be for like sleepovers or something, and it would like tell secrets or something. And so he would like have it, he would play it into the mic and then like talk about it. And I was like, oh, this is like awesome. But it was stand up, you know, it was straight up stand up. There were jokes, but it was about, you know, unconventional topics and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, that. And when I finally saw Eugene, I was like, that, I identify with that. I would like to do something like that. And so he really was my inspiration and a little bit of a mentor for me coming up. I remember once, because I had been doing stand-up for, I don't know, like 4 or 5 years, and he saw me do stand-up. He's like, you know what? I've seen you do stand-up a lot, and this was the first time you made sense. Because I started real weird. Like, my stand-up was super weird, to the point where, like, people were not... There has to be a level of shared reality between a performer and an audience, and I did not have that. I was just in my weird head and doing very strange things. So it's just been...
Can I just pin you down on some of the very strange things? Because I know there will be people listening to this who are fans of yours, newer comics, absurdists, and so forth. Let's just talk about that, the elasticity of the relationship between, like, maintaining the reality between the performer's just mad bullshit, anything's possible ideas, and actually bringing them along with you.
I would do this, and I did it a lot. I did this piece a lot, which was like, it was a, I guess, a cross between, that's why it was confusing. It wasn't like making fun of one thing or another. It was like an inspirational speaker who was all about sending your bills to jail. Like if you had bills, we could just simply incarcerate the bills. And so you wouldn't have to pay them anymore because they would be in a maximum security prison. And so like that is such a dumb idea. Like it, do you see how it mixes multiple metaphors? It also doesn't. There's no reality to it whatsoever.
And there's no human element, really. There's
Yes, there's no human element to it either. But I would just like scream very emphatically, send your bills to jail. And like, it was like a multi-step process for how to do that. And then it just like jumped the rails with that idea and went into another crazy, weird idea as well. So it was just like, it was weirdness on top of weirdness on top of weirdness. And at certain rooms, and that's the problem too.
Yeah.
In certain rooms, it destroyed because it was just so fucking weird. People were just like, I don't know what the fuck this guy's talking about, but he's very loud about it.
Yes. Almost like there is an element of, I see that a lot of like when someone is completely committed.
Yes.
Sometimes you can't help but get swept along, even though you're thinking, I don't get it, but I get that you get it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, that was like one of my earliest ones, I think. You know, I think actually the first joke I ever wrote was, it just was light, like it was dark. And then in the dark, there was a voiceover that said, now we join you for my own private Ivanhoe already in progress. And then the lights came up and I was just reading Ivanhoe. And then I looked up and then I told the audience to shh. And then I went back to reading, and then the lights went down again.
Reading it to yourself.
Just to myself quietly. Yeah.
I like that. I think that's good. That's coherent.
That's a coherent joke. Yeah. But it's a lot of buildup for one dumb pun. It's just a pun. That's all it is.
Yeah. So you'd done lots of improvisation before this.
Yeah.
So that's something I see, like, for people who have done lots of improv, they... there is, I suppose, more of a, I don't know, more courage necessarily, but more idea of what's possible.
Yeah.
You can see how someone could commit to an apparently senseless concept.
Yes, I think that is, and I do think that people are always asking me like, oh, well, so you improvised for so long, that must have really helped when you started to do stand-up. And I don't know if it did. Like, the thing that it helped was for me to feel comfortable standing on stage. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much it. Because I think the stand-up brain and the improv brain are so radically different, at least for me. I found it... I expected to be, I essentially started over because I didn't start doing stand-up until I was 29. So I'd been improvising from 22 to 29 thinking, oh, well, this is going to be no problem. And it was such a problem. I was just really bad at stand-up for so long.
Because part of you felt like, I guess I could just improvise some stand-up.
And I had done that too. I used to do I had a fully improvised one-man show that I used to do where I would do a Harold by myself. So playing like multiple characters called the One Man Jam. So I was like, okay, well, I can do that. And that was successful. I can probably do the stand-up. And then I was like, nope, I can't.
Can you tell me about that moment of realization? Like, or a series of moments? Like, did you...
Oh, yeah.
How much did you... Yeah, I'm kind of put us in that, if you will, because that's like you're someone who is very, very proficient in both camps. So the moment when you realize the two things are not the same is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it was the very first hot tub show, 2005, February 22nd, 2005 was my birthday. And that's why I remember the date. And it was a very tiny theater, 40 person theater called The Pit in New York City. So we probably had like 40 or 50 people in there. And it's the first one, very exciting, and Kristen and I do our bit, and it goes really well. And we have, like, three bits, and then Kristen does her bit, and she'd been doing stand-up, quote-unquote, for, like, 5 years. And so she had bits that just worked, She does really well. All the other comics do well. And then I go up to do stand-up, and it's two dead silence for 5 minutes. Like, I only wrote 5 minutes, but it was two dead silence. And I was like, what? And it was like this crazy feeling of like, because I hadn't, like I had bombed in doing improv. It's inevitable. But it was like not that, where I was like presenting something that I had prepared.
Yeah.
Like I had worked hard on it. When improv bombs, it's like, oh, well, you know, we missed the mark that time. No worries. It's throwaway. Sure. But this was like...
That's the difference, isn't it? Stand-up is promising to make you laugh with something I've prepared.
Yes. And improv is more or less like, well, I don't know. We'll see what we get.
And is there an element of that, looking back now after many years doing stand-up, do you have a different appreciation on a way it could have gone or parallels that there could be? Because I think there are stand-ups who you can play stand-up with a sort of let's see how this goes quality.
Yes. Yeah, yes, possibly, you know. When I started thinking about what I liked about stand-up, and what I liked about stand-up was like a ton of little jokes. Like that's the thing that I really liked. I think about Dave Attell. I remember before I even wanted to do stand-up, I remember listening to that first Dave Attell record and just being like, there's so many crazy little weird jokes here. And I like that. It's just like, bam, 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 bam. I like that. I just love listening to jokes, you know? And so that's what I wanted to do. And so I think because of that, the fact that that's the aesthetic that I liked, I did go away from kind of more of like a Rory Scovel kind of like, let's just see what happens on, you know, when I'm doing stand up.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's quite hard to riff one liners.
Yeah. because that's what I think I like. That's what I was like, well, if we're doing stand up, like, let's do it. That's what in my head, I think, you know, as opposed to improv. But I don't know. I think that maybe was a process that I had to go through. And it's now I'm trying to get back more to a less structured time on stage. And I still have trouble doing it.
Okay. I saw you at Montreal. It was the show where you took people outside with a frame.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm afraid to say I saw the frame bit from afar, having decided I didn't. You know, earlier in that show, you would say, you know, well, I can't remember what the mechanism was, but it was whether or not you trust me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, I trusted you, but I thought, I'm also a comic and I don't want to get put up on stage. I don't know what's going to happen here. So I didn't do it. But I snuck around the side of the building afterwards and like, what am I missing out on? And that was a beautiful thing. That felt very Edinburgh Fringe to me.
Yes. Well,
that kind of idea.
I put it together for Montreal because I was doing, I guess, like a month of a run or 3 week run in Montreal. And I had been, I've never done a solo show at Edinburgh, but I kind of have an idea of what an Edinburgh solo show, concept is. And so I wanted to kind of try my hand at that, I think.
Okay.
And this was the finale. And just to explain it to people who didn't see the show, I would like the hour was called Trust Me, which I later recorded for Comedy Central. And it does exist out there. You can listen to it, but it's in a different version than what it was when I was doing it in Montreal. And I asked the audience if they trusted me and if you trusted me to come up and get a blindfold from stage. And this was like right before like the last 8 or 10 minutes of the show. And then some people would come up and get a blindfold. And then I would finish the show, and then I would say, if you have a blindfold, please join me over on like the side. And then I would blindfold everyone, and then the rest of the audience would leave. But then the people who trusted me, I would blindfold them all, and then we would walk down these like rickety stairs. I don't know which venue you saw me in. And they would come out, and I had like two stagehands holding this giant frame. Like a frame, like it was like 8 feet by 6 feet or something like that. And so it was framing a corner of the city of Montreal. And then I start like played like kind of music that you would almost like hear in a like the opening of a movie, I imagined. And then I told them, like, when you take your blindfold off, like everything you see, it was purposefully made for you. like for this moment, and then what happened, and then whatever, it was just the street corner, you know, it was just whatever was happening on the street corner. But then all of a sudden, when you put this like framing around it, it really becomes like, it's an old theater exercise, you know? It's like an old clowning exercise, I think. But just making it kind of like purposeful, it's oftentimes would be very beautiful. It oftentimes would, everything all of a sudden, like somebody just going into a store and then coming out again becomes purposeful. It becomes like fascinating and beautiful if you think of it all as being choreographed as opposed to completely random. Yeah. And like that idea that randomness is choreographed, which is kind of like, that could be the reality of the situation. Do you know what I mean? Like if we look at time, right? If we talk about
keep going. I want to hear this.
If we talk about how time, space-time continuum actually does exist, like all of our moments, we experience time linearly, but like time doesn't exist linearly. It actually exists as a big landscape. And all of the things that we have done, we were always doing. And this is just like deep physics shit that I barely understand. But I've seen a map of it, you know, where you actually like take your three-dimensional map and then you expand it outward with every moment of your life and everything that's been happening. But it's all there. It's all actually in reality. Like everyone who is ever alive is still alive, you know, from a quantum physics level. Everything that ever happened is currently happening right now. But we happen to just be locked into experiencing it in a linear way. Like there's that Kurt Vonnegut has in one of his books, he talks about Trafalgars or whatever.
Oh, Trafalmadorians.
Yeah, the Trafalmadorians. Yeah. And it says like humans are they experience time like you're looking through a metal tube that's attached to a push cart that's on a railroad track. And you're looking at just one small part of a mountain as you're inexorably like going forward in time. Whereas the Trafalmadorians can just see the whole mountain, you know? And like, so that is that's kind of, to get very pretentious about the fact that it's just a fucking frame and people are looking through. I bet you a bunch of people were pretty bummed out that that's all that happened.
Well, what I thought I was thinking was, you've managed to find an admirably low-budget way of showing us that, that concept. A wooden frame and two guys.
Yeah, and two guys and a little Bluetooth speaker.
So this is Kurt. No extras on this episode. It's all here. But if you would like to get access to all of the extras from every episode that has them, which is now hundreds of hours of extra content, you can do that at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, supporting the podcast as you no doubt wish to, with a minimum donation of £2 a month or as much as you like. Everyone gets the same stuff. Also, there's exclusive insiders Q&As. There's access to special recordings with Nish Kumar, Alfie Brown, James Acaster and Fern Brady. And you know what? Maybe I'll do some more of those coming up, because I'm going to take... am I allowed to take another short break after only 9 episodes in the last 2.5 months? I think I'm going to have to, because this book is... I'm not going to use the phrase killing me, but it's certainly, if you commit to writing 1,500 words a day, particularly when you're not even, oh God, the luxury of simply making the words up, you would not believe the administration required behind the scenes to get all of the, I mean, not even all, like what, 1% of the 400 plus episodes of this podcast, of the best bits of the moments, to even find them and transcribe, that work out the best bit of the Nish Kumar episode or the most pertinent thing Tim Minchin said about whatever, and get those things and transcribe them and put them in and then reflect on them and leap from one to the other. I mean, it's mad. It's an insane endeavour. I can't believe I'm in the middle of it. We've just hit 30,000 words. And when we say we, I mean I. I do mean we, because there are some significant helpers on board whose roles will become more apparent as we go forward. But it's Muggins here. He's got to smash the words out. And I'm going to say it. It's killing me. So I'm going to take another short break. I say another. I'm feeling guilty about it. 9 episodes isn't bad. That's tons of content. I think what I'm planning to do is I've got one or two booked up, which I will put out to you in an irregular fashion. And I think probably after Christmas, I hope to have broken the back of the book by Christmas. Anyone who's written a book will be listening to this thinking, will you, mate? I look forward to seeing that. But I just need to take the pressure of interviewing and administrating and all the rest of it off, because there is so much other stuff to do. So bear with me while we do that. Go and see, go online in a travelling way. I mean, go and see Kurt if you're anywhere near anywhere he is. But I highly recommend you go to kurtbraunohler.com, KurtBraunohler.com, and download or otherwise access his album Perfectly Stupid. You will not regret it. It's excellent. You can follow him on Twitter at Kurt Braunohler and on Instagram at Kurt Braunohler. So please feel free to do that. Everything you need to get in touch with me is available at linktree.ee/Stuart Goldsmith, or go to comedianscomedian.com or stuartgoldsmith.com, where you can join the mailing list. There will probably, by the time you hear this, still be a little micro announcement at the very beginning of the episode saying go to comedianscomedian.com/unmissable to submit your unmissable moments, and holy hell, you have been doing it. Thank you. I check in on it every so often, and I'm going to have to start checking in on it every day because everyone is jumping in there. And do you know what? I'll read you a few to just give you the sense of what people are contributing. Here we are. Look at this. Elliot says, I'll just do first name so I'm not giving anything away. Elliot talks about the Lauren Patterson episode in the discussion about class and privilege, imposter syndrome, and supporting your career with a day job. Susie suggests the Robert Popper episode where he says, I take a deep breath and say, here we go. I think I referred to this one last time. Let's go further down the list. Vinay would like to point out the extra section of the Deborah Francis White episode has got some great tips about getting through job interviews. It certainly does. Jake says the Barry Cryer episode, too many great stories in this episode to single out. Not helpful, Jake. I know it's brilliant, but come on, zero in, man. Brian says Chris Addison describing getting his first experiences in the role of director and the confidence trick and responding to his gut feelings. Richard suggests the Joe Brand story about being at an awards ceremony. Duncan suggests the Gary Delaney episode and the explanation of the three parts to a joke. Paul suggests the bit when I say he's great. Unbelievable. There's just loads and loads of these. Matt berating Milo McCabe for telling himself it's okay to die, telling himself in the mirror before a show at Jonglers it's okay to die, and then proceeding to die. I'd forgotten about that. I look forward to listening back to that. Mark suggests Ria Lina feeling always on the outside of life and recognising that rather than being the slightly weird one in the office, she could be the next one on stage. All of this stuff is so, so good, and it helps me enormously to be able to scan through these and go, yes, and that kicks off another memory, it fires off another thing. I'm enjoying this process enormously. Brackets, it's killing me. But if you would like to join in killing me, by now, have I put together the domain killstew.com, which leads you to this list? No, I haven't. I haven't got time. So if you would like to join in killing me, look what Martin's done. Martin, episode 6, Adam Bloom, quote 1, there's a good chance I'll improvise another punchline under the pressure of the audience needing another joke. So useful. Thank you, Martin, because that's a thing I definitely think and know. And now I can go, look, like Adam Bloom says, and I can even work out quickly at what point he says it and what have you. So admin. As you can hear, I'm going bananas. I'm going to let you get back to Kurt Braunohler so that I can finish up this and get back down the archive mine, get back down the insight mine with my little head torch and my pick and probably a canary that dies if it hears banter. Here's Kurt. So your kind of your artistic sensibility, like to what extent is your journey into kind of strange concepts like that, or the skywriting, or the, I mean, I was listening back today to the How Do I Land, the show, which I'm afraid to say I was listening to it on a YouTube rip of the cassette upon which you released it. But the fact that you released it on cassette, the fact it's about doing a Kickstarter, as you did, to raise thousands of dollars in order to get a skywriter to write How Do I Land in the air. Those kind of like things that you could, do you have a name for that sort of stuff? Like, you know, weird shit or whatever. Like, how do you ring fence that kind of stuff as opposed to standing on a stage telling jokes?
I don't know. I don't really know if I have a name for it, because some people call them stunts, and I don't really agree with that they're stunts, and some people call them pranks, and I don't agree with their pranks. The best way I wrote a kind of sentence for myself before I did that, which was like my reason for existence as a comedian, which was to insert absurdity into strangers' lives to make the world a better place. And so that's just like, yeah, it's just inserting absurdity. For the most part.
So those moments of inserting absurdity, to what extent are they, what's the question? I mean, to what extent are they like the driving force of what you do, or are they the ideas that you have that wouldn't work as written jokes? Are they kind of like spare ideas, or spare ideas that then become more important than the other ideas? Or like, how do you see those things in the context of stand-up?
I, on a certain level, stand-up is economic on a certain level. And I think that inserting absurdities are non-economic. They function outside of me being able to make a living. You know, and so they
that's
are.
That's a really good answer. Yeah, that's a really simple. Yeah, that's right to the heart of it.
Yeah, they are simply for the beauty of the absurdity. And I think that that's how I separate them out. And I would love to just do those. You know, these goddamn kids are so hungry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it does occur to me, the skywriting. What year was the skywriting thing? Was it 2013, 2014?
I think 2013, yeah. So, like, yeah, 9 years ago.
So it occurred to me as I was listening to it, this is the sort of thing which you could sort of imagine a Mr. Beast or someone doing it now, you know, a YouTuber who kind of,
yes,
like, they've sorted out the economics.
Right,
someone
exactly.
Someone like, and I don't know much about YouTubers, I'm in my 40s, but yeah, there's this guy called, there's this one called Mr. Beast, and he seems to do some really incredible, funny ideas,
yeah,
which are often benevolent, often absurd, and I just sort of thought about the skywriting in that context, because I was like, oh, did you ever attempt to kind of connect it to an online following, or did you succeed? Maybe I don't know about whereby that could drive the economics of it, because you could sort of create a place for yourself as a professional absurdity inserter.
Yeah, and I simply did not. I simply did not do it. I think I was just trying to figure everything out for the most part. You know, I had a podcast at that time that, you know, very few people listened to. But one of the things I was doing was I was blindfolding comics and putting them in my car and driving them somewhere they've never been. And then they had to, like, figure out where they were and how they'd get home.
Yeah.
It was called Get Lost. And so, yeah, so I was trying to do that, but I wasn't on YouTube. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't wrap my head around that then. Now, just because I've been forced to, with Instagram reels and shit like that, I have been like forced to kind of like understand more how that stuff works. Now I feel like with my knowledge, if I could go back to 2013, that it should be the way I go.
Yeah. I mean, I have similar feelings about being forced to use Instagram.
Yeah.
I mean, I think of our age and our mutual, I mean, I started around 27, I think. We've seen in our different countries, in our different contexts, we've both seen the job become, I'm not going to use the word corrupted, but it's very different now.
It's,
you know,
very
like the
different.
Expectations are very different. The possibilities are so much more kind of tangible.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I feel like if I talk to someone who's a younger comic than me, who is really all on top of Instagram reels, then I feel like the dinosaur. And if I speak to a comic 5 years down the line over me, they feel like the dinosaur. And I'm like this young guy telling them what they should be doing.
Yeah.
it's this extraordinary thing that within our careers, we've seen the job change radically.
So it's so insane. And also the fact that, like, it used to be, you used to not want to burn material. Right? Like, that used to be the thing. Like, your material's precious, don't burn it. And now it's just like, burn it constantly. You have to keep this fire heated for the steam to be generated, for capitalism to exist. Throw your jokes into the fire. At all times. You have to post a fucking clip a day, man. It drives me crazy.
And how do you feel about that? It drives you crazy. Do you feel resentful?
I don't feel resentful. I mean, a little bit. You kind of a little, because what I feel resentful about is that that these systems that we have kind of, meaning Instagram Reels, meaning TikTok, meaning YouTube Shorts, they're opaque boxes where their algorithms change constantly. And so once you kind of figure out what works to actually like get your, because all you want is for somebody to see your stand up and then maybe come see one of your shows or like go buy your special. Once you figure out how it works, they change the algorithm like the next day, but there's no information on how it changes or what's being valued now. And then you're in this, all of a sudden you watch like what was like doing really well, all of a sudden crash. And then you're just like, I'm doing everything that this fucking machine wants me to do. And now I have to figure out what the new thing is by simply guessing and by simply changing small things here and there. And you're trying to like game this algorithm, which has hundreds and hundreds of architects. You know, they're changing things all the time, little details that maybe affect you a lot or maybe don't affect you at all. And that's the part that drives me crazy, where it's like they're changing it just to make sure. I don't know why they change it. They change it for billions of reasons. But yeah, that's the part that is
stop,
very...
To stop people learning how to do it, right?
To stop... Like, to I stop think it's almost
and,
like...
And then monetizing, here's how to do it.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. It's like, it's almost like as soon as you can monetize it, then it's all... Because that's what we're doing it for, right? We're doing it for, if not monetization from the actual app itself, but monetization later down the road through ticket sales or through special purchases or whatever. Mm. And that's the part that just feels like it's a treadmill that will never stop.
Yeah. I often think if that was in the initial job description, maybe I'd have done something else.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know what the other thing would be, but I think any course now that's, I know there are universities in the UK, there are one or two which offer stand-up comedy as a module. And yeah. I guess they should all be incorporating video editing training.
Yeah.
Because that's what the thing is. And also flexibility and training people in the resilience to cope with the fact that as soon as you get a bajillion followers on something, the app closes and is replaced with something else and you have to learn.
I know. I had a line I wrote for like if if I like had a heckler, which was like, hey, you look like the kind of guy who puts how many TikTok followers they have in their Instagram profile. You piece of shit.
let's talk about those kind of jokes, those sort of short jokes, little observations. I made some notes of just stuff about like fuck saxophones. the joke about hoarder. I mean, I love your joke about hoarders, which I did. I saw it on the special and then I saw it on an Instagram reel and I went, oh, I remember that one. I'll talk to Kurt about that one. But the premise that, that you know, we let billionaires have stuff, and I'm not a systems guy. I don't know if that's a good system, but I've seen Hoarders where we say this woman has 25,000 magazines. Apologies while I butcher your bit. Yeah. And we say you can't have them. That's not allowed for you to have that stuff. That is such a beautiful, elegant, big, you know, societal problem. Admission that we don't know necessarily how to fix it,
yeah,
but we're fixing it in a different context and just connecting those dots. I just think it's such a beautiful bit.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely.
It's make people very upset online, which is great.
Does
for
it really?
Views.
Oh, yeah. Why are they upset about that?
Oh, there's these right-wing fucking monsters who are just like, this person is calling for the murder of billionaires. And,
oh, so yeah.
And they're like, oh, yeah, first do, they're going to come that, for billionaires. Yeah. I do call yeah. for the murder of them. And they're like, first they're going to come for billionaires, and then they're going to come for you. And it's just like these people fighting in the comments, which is great for views. It just yes. drives it because the Instagram, the algorithm sees that and it's like, oh, yeah. And that's what I realized, too, which I do think is shitty. The algorithm, the Instagram algorithm, favors shit that's just incendiary. It doesn't yeah. favor good jokes.
yeah.
My bits that piss people off are the ones that get millions of views. Like, I have another joke where I say, fuck anybody who's ever climbed Mount Everest. And that drives bros insane. Like, they have no information about what's actually like to climb Everest. They have no information. They're just like, that's cool. Yo, you fuck you, man. That's cool. And they go crazy. And so then the algorithm is just like, throw it to as many people as possible. So it's yeah. like, that's the one thing I also don't like about it, is that it always favors incendiary stuff over actual yeah. quality content.
And as a result, a lot of the people that we think of as the big online video content producers, the Rogans yeah. and those kind of things, you know, that's definably a part of the success.
Yes. Yeah.
Saying things that people will argue over. And that yes. isn't the same as saying worthwhile things.
Exactly.
And there's no way out, Kurt. What there's do we no do? Way out.
I know. How do you write an algorithm that's like, that's a good joke? I'll throw this yeah. to a lot of people.
yeah. yeah. I volunteer to take the place of the algorithm and to watch all the stand up and go, that has a badge of quality. Just for any future artificial intelligence listening, I retract my volunteering to take the role of any algorithm. I think that could be an issue. But when it comes to making the stuff, so for example, with that bit, is that an idea that you were watching Hoarders and it popped fully formed into your head? Are you sitting down with a notebook trying to write stuff about billionaires because you're passionate about it? Where do you arrive at that bit from as an example?
The latter. It's the latter. That finding that end was a long time in the coming for it. Like, that bit used to end very differently. And it never worked. And then when I found the Hoarders comparison, it finally worked. Yeah. And I think it just got down to what drives me crazy about the concept of billionaires. It's just to have more money than you could ever spend in your entire life, or that your children's or children's children's or children's children's could ever possibly need or spend, is irrational. And it is, they're who they are, hoarders. You know, they are, they're hoarding wealth in a fucking insane way. And then, of course, in the Instagram comments, everyone's just like, they're not, that money isn't money. It's not. Money in a bank, asshole. It's and I'm like, yeah, okay, but he could sell something and then have all that money. Like, just because I have money in my house doesn't mean I don't have that money.
Yeah. I'm kind of relieved to hear. I'm excited to hear that it's through sitting down with a pen and kind of writing around the subject and trying to get there. I feel like my a few memorable episodes of this show recently have been with comics who are like, nah, it just falls into my head. I'm like, shut up, don't tell me that. I'm really interested in people wrangling with stuff. I really want to, more and more, I think I'm kind of wrangling with, I'm writing a lot about the environment at the moment and about climate change and how the fuck, you know, I think I've been for a long time a bit stuck thinking, well, if I can't propose something better as a comic, then I don't have the right to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And one way or another, I've stopped feeling that. But I think that's important. Have you ever been kind of sidetracked or waylaid by that sensation that you should be offering a solution? Or do you ever feel like, you know, having an opinion on something when you don't offer a solution is A, funny, but B, kind of sniping from the sidelines? Like a value somehow.
Yeah, I tend to think, I tend to think kind of what I say in that joke, which is like, I'm not an expert, you know, so I'm sure I do have hope that there are much smarter people than me who have dedicated their lives to thinking about economic systems. And I hope that they have a better idea, because I don't think anything that I can come up with my limited understanding of economic systems or of environmental catastrophes that I would be able to actually have a better idea. So I don't think it's just sniping from the sides to point out a problem and to make people laugh about it, because especially with things like the environment, there are still people who can't wrap their head or refuse to wrap their head around it. And so to still point at the problem is, I still think, to point at the problem and make people, while making people laugh, I still think is valuable, because until it really sinks in for everyone, nothing can change. And I think the helping sink in is not a dishonorable, desire.
Yeah, I think I go back and forth really on, sometimes I think like, is this just sort of, are we court jesters in a positive way, drawing attention, reversing stuff, or are we court jesters in a kind of I'm just playing for the court, you know, and I'm getting my money and then that'll do me. And I never really know. Sometimes I feel like nothing we say really makes that much difference. The things that make the difference are scientists and politicians and those kind of things. And then other times I feel like, well, there are reasons why I'm left wing. And a lot of those reasons are the stand-up comedy that I watched as a kid.
Do you know what I mean?
Sometimes I feel like it does have, you know, change the world type value. Do you have and I know this is, you know, it's not necessarily your stock in trade is big world changing, you know, political agitation necessarily, but do you have a bit that you are particularly proud of from the perspective of, I tackled a real thing and got something real out of it?
I think maybe, yeah, I mean, maybe that Everest bit, like that Mount Everest bit is, I still totally agree with it. I still think it sucks to climb Everest for multiple reasons. But also I realized that that joke actually came out of my mom dying, because my mom had cancer. And that's the weirdest part, that's how I weirdly got to that joke. It's in a very backdoor way, because at the time when she died, there's like 8 or 9 states now that assisted suicide is legal, but in very rare, rare, rare circumstances. And my mom had asked to die in her like last week of hospice. Her husband told me that if I helped her die, he would call the police and have me arrested. And I looked into it, and it was like, oh, that is, it's totally illegal. You're not allowed to assist someone who died like 4 days later, but she suffered for 4 days, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what was getting me angry, thinking about these people climbing Everest, because they pay so much money to climb Everest. You pay like 60, or at least whenever I recorded that bit, it was like 6 or 7 years ago. You pay $65,000, if not more, to climb Everest. And the potential of you dying is pretty high. And that's totally legal. And that's how I got into that bit, which was just anger over the fact that assisted suicide is not legal. And I think that that's one of my biggest, truest beliefs, is that assisted suicide should be legal. It should be very regulated, but it should be legal, especially for terminally ill patients.
And now we'll go to a sting. The end of the show. It's perfectly stupid.
Perfectly stupid. Yeah.
Perfectly stupid.
Out right now. On moment.co, if you're listening.
Oh, yeah. Let's get to that, because you've released it in quite an interesting way that I think we should talk about as well. Because so that's an interesting kind of technological experiment and an attempt to kind of wrestle control of it, what have you. But just in terms of the content, the end of that show has, again, what I think of as a sort of a more of an Edinburgh sensibility than I'm used to from an American comic, in terms of you're talking about a real thing. You're talking about the death of your mother and, you know, you've discovered your wife's pregnant and those sorts of things. Does that, did that feel like a new thing for you, or are you familiar, are you experienced at tying up an hour show in an emotional, punchy way? You know, moments when it's like, it's okay for there not to be a laugh rate at this bit, because this is a thing worth saying.
I just noticed that I like things more when they have a point to their existence so that we can laugh for a long time, but then it has kind of an emotional weight to it. Or rather, it's actually saying something about the world in a real way. And I wanted to not shy away from sadness. And also what I want, you know, that bit, again, that was one where it was just like rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting that bit. Because it's probably like a 10 or 12 minute piece that's all about, in a roundabout way, it's about my mom dying. It's specifically about this Dinosaur Jr. show that I went to. I like that. I think it's incredibly admirable and cool. And also my heart goes out to you as a UK comic that the expectation is one brand new hour every fucking year and it better have heart, asshole. Like, it's so crazy to me that you guys are on that schedule. But I think it's very admirable as well. And so, you know, I came up going, I mean, I went to Edinburgh 6 years in a row or 7 years in a row, something like that. And so I think, yeah, it always feels to me like I watch some comedy specials where I'm just like loving it and I'm loving it, specifically Americans. And then all of a sudden it just ends. I'm just like, what's happening? It's over?
yeah.
And it's always like, why is that the last joke? You know?
It's weird, but my theory on that, and tell me from your perspective whether you think this is right, there is a habit amongst American comics, and I think it's born of the majority of your experience, your live experience being headlining clubs at the weekend, where people kind of go, I've got three huge bits I can do here. I'll do one of them. That was big enough. And then people almost go, thank you so much, over the big laugh. And they're out. It's like, rather than having a predetermined shape, it's just the nature of it's like, I'll do that. I guess I'll do that. Any of these bits could close on. Boom, that went off. See ya.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. And how does it work when you tour and do a weekend in the UK? How is it different?
Well, touring and doing a weekend is kind of two different things. So touring would be someone doing their hour-long show or
in a theater,
40 minutes in a break and an hour in a theater or in a comedy club, you know, a smaller kind of tour. Uh-huh. But that would be much more like the end of that would be very structured like an Edinburgh show.
Okay.
Because the vast majority of us have grown up through the Edinburgh process,
right.
So you definitely know what your last bit is,
yeah.
And chances are there are a load of callbacks, arbitrary or otherwise, that kind of tie it neatly and put a bow on it, and you go, that's definitely the end.
Uh-huh.
Less so, I think, if you're doing a weekend club, but as you know, in the circuit over here, is the comedy club circuit is less fixated on a specific headliner who's the main draw.
Oh.
And it's much more like there will be three or four comedians and you'll get whatever you're given. Oh, it's great. Well, it's a very different economic model. There are pros and cons.
Uh-huh.
One of them is it is possible to be a working full-time comedian without being famous because...
So beautiful.
Oh, man, it's great. That is, I would say, on the way out now because...
Oh, really? You know,
there's an economic crisis. There's a huge surplus of comedians and it's much, much harder to achieve that. I think it's possible, but it's all of those other qualifiers, like it's much harder to do that if you're a working class background or you mm-hmm. don't have people who can support you or you've got children and you know all of those sorts of things play into it more, even more now than they did.
Yeah.
The history of the UK there.
I remember doing stand-up gigs in London and then like doing 10 minutes and then they just gave me £150, which at the time of the exchange rate was like $300 for me.
Yeah, man.
And I was like, what? Like in the States, like if you do a 10 minute spot at a club, maybe you get $20 to $50. But all the other bar shows that we do, nobody gets paid. You get paid in two drink tickets. And so it was so insane to me to be like, oh, you could just walk around and do a couple spots and make $450, like £250. That's amazing. It's so amazing. Yeah. The system is great. But it demands that you write a new hour every year.
Yeah. or I mean, there are people get away without that. There are people who are very widely respected kind of club acts who don't have anything like that kind of turnover. But I think we could talk about that for a long time. But I think as it pertains to your show, it's we were talking about the like wanting to finish at a specific endpoint. You would be talking, I think I've slightly lost my thread. We were talking about the ending of the show, the emotional resolution of the show.
Yeah. I wanted it to have a point for existence. Yeah. You know, and I wanted it to be about my mom because I recorded my previous special. I had recorded it in, my mom died in July and I recorded it in October. All the material was written and, you know, good to go. So I had there was no extra, there's no way to write it about her. And so I wanted this hour to in some way be about her, especially because this hour is about me becoming a dad. And so much of becoming a parent, for me at least, was wrapped up in the fact that the parent who raised me was no longer there. Because as soon as you become a parent, I think it's the first time you think of your parents as human beings, because you're actually going through the specific things as a human being. And you're not just thinking of them as parents, but like that's a person who did all these things that I'm doing now. And especially having all these questions then and about my mom, not only as like, not only for child rearing, but also about her as a person. It just shed a new light on my mom for me after I had a kid. And so I kind of wanted it to be, if this special is going to be about parenting in some way, then I really do need to address her. And I think she should be the emotional through line for the show.
I'm not saying for a minute that you do this at all, but was there the concern when writing stuff about becoming a dad that you then fall into the stand-up tropes? You know, the kind of, I mean, I remember on the How Do I Land show, there's a lovely bit where you're talking about airports rather than flying. But you're talking about airports. There's a lovely bit of address to the audience going, is he doing the airport material? Yes, we're doing it. You know, kind of go that lovely kind of alt mainstream meshing together and going, I'm going to do some generic stuff about airline. But it was there a fear in kind of writing material about being a dad, because that is becoming a parent, that's a well-worn path.
Yeah.
Is that part of the writing and part of the quality control that you have to go, how could I not say things about this universal experience about which 1,000 comics before me have said something?
Oh, completely. I was completely aware of it the whole time. And I think being aware of it is half the battle, honestly, because you know that the joke really has to stand without being simply, because, you know, audience will applaud for just children in general. and to avoid any like schmaltziness, I think was right, you know, in the front of my brain the whole time writing that stuff. And I hope that I have created something that's very specific and unique and that hopefully doesn't smack of things that have come before it.
You have. Don't for a minute think I'm there.
not at all.
Like a softball intro to me going, well, you say that.
I was thinking about it a lot, I think.
I think I read in another interview that you did about your process for making it with the director, with like the literal director of the special. Which that seems to look quite unusual that the director, as in the person that organized which camera is pointing where, was also a creative in the sense of like feeding back on jokes or working with you on jokes. Is that right?
Yes. Jonah Ray Rodriguez. He's a good friend of mine and a former stand up. He's given up stand up comedy, which was great for me.
because on this podcast, we say completed, Kurt.
they completed being a stand up.
Yeah.
That is, I got to tell him that. He'll really like that. He completed being a stand-up. And so he has great sensibility. He writes tags for me. He really helped me structure. And he had been arguing with me, like, you need to end with the piece about your mom. Like, that's the ending part of the show. And I was like, no, it's too sad. We'll put that in the middle. And then I ended with that, with the billionaires thing. I was like, that's always like a big, it's a, and then when we watched it, It was actually Point Grey, the production company, that's like, I think you need to end with this. And I was just like, well, I would like to apologize to you, Jonah. you were right. I should have ended with that. But it is tough because I would, my ideal audience, my ideal venue would be a theater. I just simply cannot sell enough tickets. And so I am forced to play clubs. And so it's good in the fact that I constantly have to go up in front of people who have no idea who I am, and I have to convince them that they're going to have a good time and they're going to laugh, and then make them laugh with, and so that's good in honing things, but it's bad in the fact that sometimes I respond to the wrong inputs. But once you look at it as a piece, once it's shot in a theater, you can see this should be here where it needs to be. And that was the only big move that we made, was we had to switch out those two pieces.
Got it. When you say you respond to the wrong inputs, that's, if I'm understanding correctly, it's that thing of like chasing the biggest laugh has to go at the end because you're a club act.
Exactly.
And being aware, yeah, I think that's really important. I think to recognize the difference in the different contexts that you perform.
Yeah.
And go, oh, I'm constantly, that's kind of one of the things I mean about the pros and cons of the way the UK circuit is different to the States. There are lots of benefits. Or the way the Edinburgh, you could say, oh, the American comics are very impressed by British comics' ability to turn over an hour a year. Or you could say, American comics would say, don't do that, the quality will be lower. You know, and those are both accurate.
It does seem like I would, if I had to make a new hour every year, the quality would be lower. I know, just because like I work for 3 or 4 years on an hour. And I know when it's 2 years old or 1 year old, it's a certain thing. And then when it's 4 years old, it's another thing completely. But I still admire it. God damn. It's just must be terrifying to be like in August, like in September, it must be like, oh, all right, here we go again.
Yeah. Over the years, I think I've written 10 hours now. And over the years, I've got it down to February. Like February, I'm like, whew, here goes. But I think I've got a slightly more scovel kind of take on it now. You know, I think I'm a bit more inclined to go, the thing is the thing that it is on the night. Whereas I think previously I would have tried to build a perfect crystalline structure that's like, that's that hour.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm a bit more inclined to go. I mean, also, I just felt like I can't spend my life going, August, done, September the 1st. Experience some new things. That feels preposterous, you know. And you see that you do see it in the show. Often people go a year on, a year off, good show, bad show, because you know, there was you've been to Edinburgh, you've seen shows where like people have clearly done a fun experiential thing in order that they can write an Edinburgh show about it. That doesn't seem the right way round at all. Before we wrap up, tell me I'm interested in how you view yourself as a comic. How do you view your success? This is something I only ask people that I consider to be successful. Why aren't you more successful than you are?
Right. That is I ask myself that question all the time. But also what I do realize, too, is that everyone asks themselves that, you know. I remember hearing about what's his name? Ben Stiller. Ben Stiller tried to get that terrible movie Walter Mitty made for 10 years, and people kept saying no to him. So Ben Stiller, arguably during his tenure, was probably the most powerful American comedic film actor, and he couldn't get the movie that he wanted to make. He could not get it made. For 10 years, people just had no to Ben Stiller. And so no matter what level you're at, there will always be something that seems out of your reach, and it will frustrate you, and you have to find joy in just the work itself, because like there's always someone more famous than you. There's always someone more successful than you. That being said, God damn it, I'd love it if I could just sell a weekend out. That's all I want. I just want a sold out weekend. Can I not have fucking one sold out weekend, please?
And how do you, thank you for your, for that candid response. I mean, it's something I'm frustrated with as well. Like I produce some really good work, but it's, there's always like, just get on that. I want to be on that.
I just want to be on this next little thing. One. It's a very one. Yeah.
Do you find, how old are your kids now?
3 and 5.
So my kids are 6 and 4. Okay. And something that's been happening in the, so I outrank you. So something that's happened to me in the last year and a half, and obviously the pandemic has kind of had an effect on that as well, is that the idea of going away, now that my son started school, the idea of going away for weekends to do club gigs feels selfish. Uh-huh. You know, it's without a, as I knew it would, as soon as we were pregnant with our first child, we were like, I knew, oh shit, I've got 5 years to get more successful than I am now so that I don't have to tour everywhere.
Yeah.
Is that, how does that kind of weigh on you? Are you aware of that? Are you, you know,
constantly.
Yeah, daddy's got to go and fulfill his dream, kids. So I'm not going to see you all weekend now.
It's really, it's tough. And my wife and I talk about it all the time, where we're just, we made a very, I'm forgetting my words. We made a very conscious choice. That's what I wanted to say. We made a conscious choice once the kids were born that I would try to look for work in town so that I could be here. And it's just a crapshoot, you know? It's if you sell something or if you get in a writer's room, then that's great. Now you're in town. But it's those things are just much harder to do. I can always go and do comedy and make money enough, at least for us to get barely by. You know, so that's how it feels. It feels like this, again, like I don't know what the future looks like.
And are you pitching and are you trying to get in writers' rooms and are you doing all of those things?
Yeah, we've written, my wife and I have written 2 separate movies. Right now we're looking to actually get a director for one of them. And we just did a whole round of network pitching from May until just recently that didn't go. We were lucky enough 2 years ago to sell a show to NBC, but then that didn't end up getting shot. So, you know, it's just like, and then once you're in Los Angeles, like the development cycle can take up all your time. It can take up all of your writing and all of your actual time. And then all of a sudden you look at last 4 years and you're like, well, what happened? Like I wrote so many things, but only like a couple executives read them. And that seems very frustrating where it pays the bills, but you're like, well, what are we doing? So that's why that actually feels nice to have a movie to point to, like a script. I physically printed it out and put it on the bookshelf just to be like, there's 4 years of my life.
And this is a movie. This is the one you're looking for a director for.
Yes, yes, yes.
Can you tell us anything about it or is it all?
Yeah, I found out my mom had a kid in high school before me that would have been kept secret for her entire life. And so it's about going to look for him. So it's about 2 half brothers looking for a brother they didn't know they had after their mom died.
And do you, when you start writing that movie, if you're writing scripts and dialogue a lot, because that's not something I've spent much time doing at all. The process in the UK is so arcane and filled with disappointment. It feels like it's the same experience that you're having, but with so far fewer opportunities and a general kind of vibe. Like I've been to meetings in America where you just glide out going, wow, we're all going to be massively famous. Whereas over here, the equivalent meeting is sort of tutting and, you know what I mean? Like, well, I mean, good luck, you know. So it's, that's been my limited experience. Obviously, great work is being made by great people. But in terms of the skills required, the skill set required to sit down and put yourself into another person's shoes, but, you know, to write dialogue, to write character rather than jokes and absurdity, what were some of the kind of the biggest things you learned in trying to do that, in trying to shape that?
The biggest things that I struggle with are, because dialogue I don't necessarily have a too hard of a time with, because it's a lot like improvising. You know, you just kind of like talk to yourself. But structure-wise, the structure of a movie and how much to, and how much do you want it to be structured like a studio film? Because you can learn a structure and you can learn, okay, this is it. First, second, third act. This is where, you know, the hero decides, you know, the whole hero's journey. That structure itself took me a very long time to get into my brain. And now I've gotten like into my brain, and now we're starting to like deconstruct it and take the pieces that I actually think are actually necessary. That's the part that's very interesting, to like learn the rules very firmly and then know exactly where you want to break them.
And did you learn those from school, from videos, from books, from seeing loads of stuff?
From books and from seeing lots of stuff and from writing lots of stuff. And you sometimes, like, if once you write a movie, you're just like, all right, this follows all the things. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a good movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's this idea that like these books will suggest to you that if you follow their instructions and you follow their structure, like you'll have a good movie. And it doesn't that's not true.
you just won't have made one of the dumber mistakes.
Exactly.
I guess. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I always mention this book on the podcast, so we'll probably edit this out. But have you read Adventures in the Screen Trade?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, you've got to read this book. So it's by by William Goldman, who wrote The Princess Bride and Marathon Man.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, it's amazing. He wrote it in the 80s, I guess, about a kind of movie heyday of the late 70s. And he talks about the beats of a story and how, you know, any movie you watch and you're thinking, well, I liked it, but it just didn't work. It's because they fucked the beats up. I really recommend it. It's super fun and funny to read as well.
What is so fucking fascinating about structure is that it operates purely on a subconscious level. Like, you don't notice the structure. You just feel not good about a movie. That's what I think is fascinating about it. When you're just like, oh, why don't I like this? And then you think about it, you're like, oh, it's because the structure is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do some quick fire stuff just to wrap up with. Tell me first have you launched, or are you about to launch the special via?
It is out right now.
What was the way that you released it?
So it's a three-tier release. The first tier is on Moment, which is kind of like a new way of getting specials direct from comedians to fans.
And so it's Moment House. Is that Moment House?
They used to be called Moment House. And of course, before even anyone knows exactly what they are, they have changed their fucking name. So helpful for everyone across the board.
Moment. Got it.
So it's called Moment. It's moment.co. And they stream live concerts, but they're also doing pre-recorded comedy specials. And so you can get a ticket, quote unquote, for $12 and watch a special for the next 3 weeks. So it's up there until I think November 15th or 17th. Okay. And then starting on November 16th, it will go to TV on demand outlets like Amazon and whatever you guys have in the UK. That's just like, you know, you can buy for $18 or whatever, you can buy a movie. Mm-hmm. It'll be in all those things, Google Play, all that sort of stuff. And then it's there for 1 month, and then it comes down off that, and then it will go to YouTube and Amazon Prime with ads. So it'll be with ads on YouTube and with ads on Amazon Prime. And that's kind of the idea being that it really does take someone like 3 or 4 times seeing like an advertisement for the thing before they're like, all right, I'll watch it. I'll give it a chance. And so by the time it gets to YouTube, you've had like 3 rounds of press coverage for it. So hopefully people will see it then. And then along the way, we hopefully maybe make our money back because we shot it on spec, you know?
Okay. Yeah. And how much are you a part of those decisions? Is that like that the decision to do it in that particular way?
100%.
Yeah. Okay. Did that come from you?
No, the structure did not come from me. That is the production company. We one of the production companies, 800 Pound Gorilla. This is the way they...
Lovely bunch of guys.
Yeah, they're great.
They did my special as well. It's great.
They've kind of like said, like, look, this is, we've had success with this model in the past. And so, yeah, so far it's going great. And all that being said, if someone wants to watch it, they can just go to perfectlystupid.com and every place that it's available will pop up.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Nice. Succinct.
Yeah.
What's your three or four quickies, quick fire ones before we wrap up? Thank you for your time, Kurt. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, thank you.
What's your favorite opening line of another comic?
Oh, man. I mean, I think it's Bernie Mac at what he had that at the, I think it was a Def Comedy Jam, and he just comes out and goes, "I ain't afraid of you motherfuckers." Yeah,
you don't understand. I ain't afraid of you motherfuckers. That's, I mean, that's pretty incredible. Who is the best comedy writer? Stand-up. Who writes the best stand-up?
Who writes the best stand-up? Ooh.
For themselves, or you know what I mean? Yeah. But like, who's the best stand-up, brackets, writing, as opposed to who's the best stand-up, brackets?
Probably Stuart Lee.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sure everybody says that in the UK. But in the United States, if I said that, people would be like, who's that?
Yeah, sure. No one says it in the UK. It's a bit obvious. Well...
Over here, that's a brilliant answer. I just want you to know.
If you had one quality which got you where you are, besides your comic ability, besides your actual ability to do the comedy bit of it, mm-hmm. what would it be?
My relatively small shoe size as compared to my height, I would say. It's rare. It's a rare combination. And I think people can feel that from me.
What's your shoe size?
I don't know. It's not going to translate. I'm like a 9.5.
Yeah. That is unusual. Is that a breastfeeding thing?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. How do you cope? What do you say to yourself when it all goes wrong? What do you say to yourself on stage when something bombs or afterwards when you're reflecting on it?
Oh, it is. It's written right here on the wall.
Oh.
Try again, fail better.
Very nice.
That's Samuel, a Beckett quote.
Samuel Beckett. Very nice. Just to stay with that for a second, do you say that to yourself in the moment? Or is that a thing you say like when you're licking your wounds? Like if you're on stage, you've just told a joke, it's got okay. nothing. What
bombs.
Do you think? Like not even like a mantra, but what do you think? What's that experience like? How do you get to the next one? What's the impulse?
It's usually to be like, well, this is surprising. Well, look at how unique this moment is. Like there is a certain beauty in a bomb. Right. I was hired to do 20 minutes at the Bel Air Country Club. Like, you know, the place where they took the Fresh Prince.
I don't know what
Prince.
That is, but I feel like I know what that is. Yeah.
Bel Air is the most wealthy part of Los Angeles. And so this is the most wealthy part of the most wealthy people. And it's their country club. So it's a golf course. And I was hired to do 20 minutes there. And I was like, I don't have any jokes about golf. I don't do crowd work. Are you sure you want me to do this? And they're like, yeah, these dudes just love to laugh. And I came and I did 20 minutes. No shit. 20 minutes. 20 minutes to dead silence. To dead silence. No one smiled. It was insane. And at a certain point, I was just like, this is amazing. I started talking to the audience about it. I was like, do you guys understand that I'm telling you jokes? Like, is this performance art at this point? Like, it was just like thrilling and crazy and embarrassing and awful. While it was happening, I was like, oh, this is a bit. I'm going to make this into a bit.
Last question. Are you happy?
I think I am. Yeah, I do think I'm happy. I realize right now that I'm in a very, I will look back in this time of life and be like, this was a good time. My wife's mother is still alive and she's healthy and the kids are safe and they're healthy and we're all together. And that's like more than anyone can ask for. And so I try and really just appreciate that every day.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
So that was Kurt Brownola. Remember, do try and catch Perfectly Stupid. Follow him, particularly follow him on Instagram. We talked about that a little bit. Go to follow him at Kurt Brownola on Instagram, because he's been putting up loads and loads of little clips. So see if those whet your appetite. The very viral Billionaires one in particular is very, very funny, if we haven't already spoiled the punchlines in the episode. Thank you, Kurt. KurtBrownola.com for everything to do with him. ComediansComedian.com/insiders if you'd like to stump up your hard-earned cash to support this project. Yeah, it's not just a podcast, mate. It's a project. It's a podject. God, I hate myself. Or comedianscomedian.com/unmissable if you would like to submit your unmissable moments and gradually kill me between now and Christmas. Get stuck into that. I've just mentioned Christmas. I was going to get round to doing merch. There's no possibility this year. I'm so sorry. Next year you can buy the book. How's that? That's everything. Thank you to producer Nathan for sorting everything out. Thank you to Moz for logging. The music was by Rob Smouten. Susie is now helping me enormously with the archiving, the interpretation of the archive, additions to the archive. I'll think of a job title for Susie soon, but thank you. You deserve a shout out on the pod as well. And also welcome, let's quickly welcome some new insiders who are all owed a little personal message from me that they will receive in the next half an hour. I've committed to it now. This is awful. Including Mandy, Alexandra, James, Mitchell, Lewis, Ben, KS, love that, Mohammed, Lisa, and Andrea. Thank you all very much. You are the people who have, you are some of the people, a sprinkling of the people who've joined between September and now. And you all get a special something for a reason that will become apparent. Yes, fascinating. Not goodbye forever. Goodbye for now. That's tedious. Goodbye then. I was supposed to come up with another sign off. What did I say on the Infinite Sofa? I remember. I used to love that. It's the first time I had a proper sign off. Look after yourselves. I can't be bothered.